Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome to All of It. You're listening to WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and this is a very special edition of All of It. This is our first ever, and maybe it could be annual, crossover show with New York Magazine. It's a two-hour, best of 2018 All of It New York Magazine mashup. Six segments, six different topics, curated end of 2018 lists from our favorite New York Mag critics and writers telling us their favorite art and culture that they consume this year. And our listeners, we want to hear from you as well. We're keeping the lines open all show, and we want to hear from you about your year-end best of picks. Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We're going to start with television. It's been debatable when the golden age of television started, but there has been an explosion of new ambitious shows year after year, and with Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu now solidly in the original programming game, there's been almost too much to watch, which is why we need professionals. Enter New York Magazine TV critic Matt Zoller-Seitz. While no amateur could watch all the new shows out there, a pro like Matt certainly tried, and here to talk about his top 10 best TV episodes, specifically episodes of 2018. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how you doing?
Welcome back to All of It.
Thank you.
Again, listeners, if you want to tell us what some of the best TV you've seen this year, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Okay, so Matt, what did an episode need to have to make it to your list this year?
Well, it needed to be an exceptional example of a particular type of episode. And there's a lot of different types of episodes. And one thing I wanted to avoid, which I've certainly been guilty of in past years, is having a list of best episodes that concentrates on momentous events, like somebody dies, a baby is born in an elevator, you know, an army of, you know, zombies attacks the city, whatever. those are great episodes. And when well done, they're amazing. But in serialized TV particularly, and even in something like a sitcom where it's kind of telling more self-contained stories, when you get to an episode like that, the reason it's so powerful is because they've laid the groundwork for it. So I did have some of those big kind of momentous narrative high watermark type episodes on the list, but I also tried to do what I call give honors to what I call housekeeping episodes, where they're kind of doing the tedious, regular, everyday detail work that makes the big splashy finale possible.
Now, you're listing not just 10 episodes, but 10 separate shows. Were you tempted to list any show more than once on this list?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I've done it. I think almost every I've been doing this for 21 years now, writing about TV. And every year when I've done an episodes list, I've found ways to kind of spread the wealth. And you know, there are some shows where, honestly, there are certain years where certain shows are so good that five of the top 10 episodes that I've seen would be from one show. And I rarely went that far, but there were years when, like, an episode of, like, Mad Men or The West Wing or something like that might have more than one episode. And last year I put two episodes from Twin Peaks: The Return on my list, and I've done it many times. And I also have cheated. Like, my editors just they fight with me every year. I always go to them and say, can I do a top 25 episodes list? And if you go back and look, if you do a Google search, you'll find that the first couple of years that I was at the magazine, I went completely berserk, and I did a list of top 25 comedy episodes and top 25 drama episodes for a total of 50. And eventually an editorial decision was made to hose me down and make me stop doing that. So now I've been limited to 10.
I applaud your discipline this year, Matt. I applaud it.
Well, it's not my discipline. Thank my editors.
All right. Number 10, you have Lodge 49. And in your review of the show, you call Lodge 49 a charming stroll through the ruins of late capitalism.
Yeah. What do you mean? Yeah, this show, it's funny. Every year there's two or three shows that are not necessarily positioned as the next big thing. and they sort of creep up on you. And by you, I mean everyone who watches it, including television critics. And one of them this year was Lodge 49. It was fun to see, and I certainly was a late adopter. Like, I reviewed the first couple of episodes, but I didn't realize how special it would become until a couple of my colleagues started saying, oh my God, this show is really turning into something amazing. And so I did a quick catch up, and each episode impressed me more and more. And the one that I selected for this list is Apogee, which is an episode like we just discussed. It kind of sets up the finale. They've got this is the story of a group of essentially struggling middle to working class people in Long Beach, California, where the industry that used to provide jobs has left. And they're kind of figuring out how they're going to, you know, meet their next paycheck. And a lot of them are temping, and a lot of them are working more than one job. It's really kind of unusual in how much attention it pays to the struggle just to make ends meet. That's not something TV is usually interested in, mainly because a lot of people find it to be kind of a bummer. Mm-hmm. You know, they watch TV. They don't want to be reminded of how hard life is. But this one does remind you of how hard life is, and it's very sweet and funny at the same time that it does it. And this is an episode where they're putting together all of these narrative plot lines, including Sean Dudley and his sister Liz, who their father died. They believe he committed suicide, but they aren't sure. And they're kind of the main two characters on the show. And he's joined a lodge, a fraternal lodge, and he's kind of found this community and a sense of family that he hadn't felt since the death of their father. And they're also struggling what to do on the family business. But this is a great episode because it's a large cast. There's a lot of eccentric characters, and they bring them all together. Each of them has something pivotal happen to them that sets them on the course towards the big finish, including, I won't spoil it for anybody, but they introduce a harpoon. There's this rich guy who in his house, he has a harpoon. And as soon as you see that harpoon gun, that 18th century harpoon gun from the deck of a whaling vessel, you know that thing is going to get fired. And it's brilliant because they introduce it at the beginning. And you think, who's going to get hit with that harpoon? Will they be wounded or only killed? What's going to happen? And they finally do shoot it. And it's just completely something you could never guess happens with that harpoon. And it's great. I love that kind of cheekiness when people are writing a show.
I want to ask you about 9 and 10. They're both from Netflix, and they're both shows that didn't make it last year. GLOW, Glorious Ladies of Wrestling, at number 9, and number 8, Dear White People. Were these shows, programs just that much better second season? Sometimes sophomore season isn't good, but in this case, it seems
I wrote a piece. I wrote a piece a number of years ago about the importance of the sophomore season, and I do think season 2 is when a good show becomes great, or suddenly reveals that there wasn't that much there to begin with, and that they didn't have that many ideas. And both of these shows, GLOW and Dear White People, I think I liked them a lot in their first season, but I really think they both leveled up in season 2. And the episode of GLOW that I chose is it's built around the show is kind of the narrative through line of this thing is the rivalry between Ruth, played by Alison Brie, and Debbie, played by Betty Gilpin. And in the very first episode of season 1, we saw that Ruth slept with Debbie's husband. And they're part of the same wrestling troupe, and that animosity kind of feeds into their relationship, where Debbie is playing this all-American, star-spangled kind of character, and Ruth is playing one of the villains, one of the heels, and she's a Russian with an exaggerated Russian accent. And it's the 80s, so it's like Rocky IV or something like that. And this is an episode where it's fairly late in the second season, and they get in the ring together for one of their many melodramatically hyped-up bouts between, the spirit of the USA and the evil Soviet Union. And Debbie kind of goes berserk in the ring.
With a little help from cocaine. We should say that.
That's the sequel to With a Little Help from My Friends. But I just was amazed at how they were able to take this show, which has, it's melancholy, but essentially it mostly has a light tone, and suddenly inject this note of kind of savagery into it. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah. No, it was really rough to watch.
I gasped watching it, but then they ramp down and they bring it back to the tone that they usually have, and that's tough. And when you do something like that, can you imagine if an episode of Cheers, Sam punched Norm in the face and broke his nose, the show would never recover from that, but somehow this show did, and I thought that was amazing.
We want to take a call. Anastasia from Norwalk, Connecticut. Hi, Anastasia. What do you want to weigh in on?
Hi, Hi. I just wanted to highlight a show maybe not a lot of people have heard of called Wentworth. It's an Australian prison drama. It's set in a women's prison. I'm not easily impressed, but this show is intense. It's captivating. You know, you'll be yelling at your TV. I watch it on Netflix, and you really, really, really should give it a chance, Wentworth.
Anastasia, thank you so much. We're talking with Matt Zoller-Seitz, New York Magazine's TV critic, about his 10 best TV episodes of 2018. Number 7 was Homecoming, Optics. You talked about Homecoming last time you were here, so we'll move on. Better Call Saul was number 6, Something Stupid. Everybody knows about that. Sharp Objects on HBO. That show was crazy. And a great book, and crazy. And you picked the episode called Closer.
Yes.
You say that this show has the best edited series on TV.
I've said as much. I really think it's really, really very impressive. And, you know, the filmmaker Nicholas Rogue, best known for Don't Look Now, specialized in nonlinear editing, where you're kind of shuffling between past and present and between, you know, memory and what's happening in front of the characters and also possibly some things that are imagined. And you're sort of just supposed to be able to sort through it all and make sense of it. And not too many movies or television shows are edited in that way. And Rogue passed away not too long ago this year. And Sharp Objects is a show that is made very much in that spirit, that kind of experimental art film spirit. And in its heart, it's really a very kind of traditional pulpy journalism slash murder mystery about this reporter who goes to a small town in southern Missouri, her hometown, to try to solve a murder, which turns into a series of murders. And so it's kind of, you're kind of in like a True Detective sort of zone, but it's really remarkable how they put you in her mind. They put you in her mind, and often, like, a lot of times you're looking at things that are kind of objective, and other times you're seeing things where she'll look at somebody, she'll remember something that happened to her, and that will trigger her to remember something else, and you're kind of having this pinball machine effect. And the episode that I chose is an episode that's set at a holiday. It's like the town has a big event where they celebrate the founders, and they have this mythology about the Civil War and how the virtue of the women was menaced and how they rose up against their oppressors and all of this. And it's a great kind of like a Robert Altman movie where they're bringing together every single character all in one place in the backyard of the heroine's mother's house, the Calhoun Day celebration, it's called.
Yeah, sort of Southern Gothic vibe on this whole show as well.
Yeah, it's great. And they also use sound really, really exceptionally well on the show. And it's subjective. The use of sound is subjective. And they do this thing where when people flash back or they imagine something, you hear whatever they're hearing in the room at that moment, you continue to hear it, but it's muffled. So it's kind of like the effect of when you're zoning out, you know, like in life. It's really, really very well done.
Let's take a quick listen to a clip from Sharp Objects.
Turns out, Missouri is the fifth most productive state in terms of carrying out executions. We had to stop. Fluid was controversial. I think it was killing people well enough. Well, in any case. I just read that we imported from Romania.
Fluid for lethal injections. Needles.
Like the needles I get sometimes?
Very different.
That is a very creepy dinner conversation. That was dinner.
The sound of the piano, they've mic'd it so that you hear it like coming from the next room, and it sounds like it's coming from somebody's memory.
It was so good and so creepy. Okay, so your top four all happen to be from FX. The Assassination of Gianni Versace, Atlanta, the Teddy Perkins episode. I'm going to tell people they just need to go look at that one.
that one is really something else.
The American Start, and number one is Pose. Love is the Message. Why does this stand out for you? Why is it number one?
Well, it's a lot of reasons, but, you know, for starters, and I didn't put this in the capsule because it didn't seem appropriate, but, you know, I was estranged from, this is a show that's very much about motherhood and about the concept of motherhood. And people who, you know, a lot of people who go to the big city from a suburb or a small town, because they don't fit in for one reason or another, usually because of an issue of sexual orientation or identity, and they find a new home. They make a new family in New York with people who may not be their blood relations. And also, in the meantime, people who live in New York are having trouble with their own blood family. So it's kind of a the whole thing is a meditation on family and the idea of family. And this show and this particular episode in particular, like, I was estranged from my mother for a number of years, and this actually, I think, I give Janet Mock, who wrote and directed this episode, credit for inspiring me to reconcile with her. You know, that's
how beautiful
this episode was. Yeah, yeah, and you know, it's wonderful when art can have that kind of an actual effect on you, like an actual tangible effect, like it makes you want to go do something. You know, preferably it would be something that's positive. You know, but yeah, this is an episode. It's, you know, the show is set in the 80s. It deals with, you know, mostly transgender people, gay and lesbian people, and straight people who are sort of, you know, maneuvering in that world. And it's set around ballroom culture and the backdrop of the AIDS epidemic. And Pray Tell, who's played by Billy Porter, who is the MC at these balls, he organizes a cabaret in the hospital ward where his lover died of complications from AIDS. And it's a quasi kind of musical episode. Like, the music is contextualized, like, it, because it's a performance that's being given, but it kind of becomes this almost otherworldly dream of beneficence and mercy and warmth. And it's just, it's really kind of overwhelming. I mean, I was kind of cathartically wiped out by this episode.
I really appreciate you sharing that with us, Matt.
Well, you know, hey, it happened. And, you know, and I recommend this show. Like, I tell everybody, you got to watch the show. I mean, I'm kind of annoying about telling people you must watch it. It's required.
You must watch it. It is required. Matt Zoller Seitz, New York Magazine's TV critic. Thanks, as always, for coming by to visit us at All of It.
All righty. Thank you for having me.
And listeners, remember, our phone lines are open. You can call us at 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. If you want to weigh in on our best ofs, of course, we just ran down some of Matt's top TV picks for 2018. Coming up next, we're going to run down Emily Yoshida's top movie picks of the year. It's the New York Magazine All of It crossover show. You are listening to WNYC. Stick around. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Throughout today's show, in collaboration with our friends at New York Magazine, we're running through six different cultural best of lists. Let's talk movies with Vulture Movies critic Emily Yoshida. Excuse me, Emily Yoshida. Sorry about that, Emily. You know, MoviePass may have disappointed this year, but films themselves did not. It was easy to rhapsodize about everything from Black Panther to The Wife, from Roma, If Beale Street Could Talk. Everyone has different movies on their top 10 lists. And our next guest has a list that's not full of the usual suspects. Her picks include directorial debuts, foreign films, animated wonders. Emily, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, movie fans, you can give us a call as well, 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. What are your top movie picks? Okay, I'm asking everybody this question at the start. What did a movie need to make it to your list?
That's a really interesting question, I think, because I've been thinking about what's a uniting theme of my list, and even the things that didn't quite make my list but I loved a lot this year. And I can't put my finger on one. I think the ones that kind of stuck out for me, and at least, and this is not always the case for me in a given year of movies, but I think this year, a movie that really felt like something I would remember watching specifically in 2018 tended to make my list.
Oh, that's interesting. Very specific to the time, the zeitgeist, what was going on.
Yeah, and I don't always think about films in that way. You know, I like to be able to think about films in, you know, as much of a vacuum as I can, like how much, you know, actual craft and just like good story there is. But a lot of my films this year were ones that just felt so inseparable from the times, and this year specifically in some ways. Yeah.
Well, let's start at number 10. Number 10 is probably the only one on your list which is sort of a popular culture favorite as well. A Star Is Born.
Oh, but what a popular culture favorite. yeah, I mean, I think there's been a little bit of backlash around this movie by now just because it's been out and it is, you know, wildly popular, at least for an awards contender type movie. But there's something about that I think was so fun. I wrote in my little blurb for it on the site that, you know, there were maybe better movies, even better movies about performance and being an artist and music that came out this year. But this one, just I saw it two times in theaters, and I just thought it was such a fun theatrical experience. It really reminded me of the big movies that got me into movies when I was, you know, a teen and an adolescent, just because they're just so sweeping and romantic. And even if it's not necessarily the most revelatory or deep thing in the world, although I do think that, that Star is Born has plenty to say about, you know, how, what it's like to be a woman in show business now, and all of the versions have over the years. But this one, I think, just had that sweep and that big kind of old movie appeal of just seeing two charismatic people sing at each other. It's great.
And there's also this sort of meta line in it about Lady Gaga, because part of, you know, I think one of the more difficult scenes, he tells her she's ugly in one of their fights. And that was something that Lady Gaga actually had to struggle with when she first came up, because she didn't look like a lot of the other pop starlets, but she had this giant voice.
Yeah, I read some, I can't remember if it was an interview or something that somebody just overheard her saying at some party after a screening, but that the one thing that she said separated her from her character Allie in the film was that Lady Gaga said that once she decided to be Lady Gaga and become a pop star, she really didn't look back, and she didn't, you know, let any of those sorts of things hold her back, even if they were, you know, deep down inside of her. And so I feel like this is a kind of more muted version of Lady Gaga. I mean, obviously there are tons of comparisons to be made between that character and the real life version of her, but I think that it seems like it was kind of an opportunity to explore some of those deeper insecurities.
Well, let's listen to those two charismatic people, Bradley Cooper, who also directed it, which we all know it's in every poster, and Lady Gaga at the beginning, sort of setting the theme for A Star is Born. We don't have the A Star is Born? Oh, well, you know what? You've all seen the trailer a million times already.
I can sing it if anybody would like me to sing it.
Oh, wait. There's been radio magic. Let's try.
Your songs or anything?
I don't sing my own songs.
Why?
I just don't feel comfortable.
Why wouldn't you feel comfortable?
Almost every single person has told me they like the way I sounded, but that they didn't like the way I look.
I think you're beautiful.
I'm falling.
Hey.
What?
I just want to take another look at you.
In all the good times, I find myself longing for change.
Here's what we're gonna do.
Come sing that song that I love.
No, I can't do that.
Here we go.
That's a completely decent song. I know why it was nominated for Grammys. All right, number 9 is called Have a Nice Day. It's an animated movie, and you wrote that this movie left you breathless.
Yeah, this is, I might be the only person to have this on their list this year, so I'm pleased to, you know, kind of stand for it in my way. I saw this more than a year ago at the Philadelphia Film Festival when I was on the jury there, and it was up for the feature prize there, and I had no idea what it was. It was one of these things that I just went into completely blind, and I was so gobsmacked by it. It's an animated film, but it's, I know some people have seen, has it come out? No. Today is today the 14th. I never know when movies come out. Into the Spider-Verse, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse comes out, and a lot of people been talking about that as far as kind of switching up frame rates and sort of the way that animation looks on screen. And if you want to see a really low frame rate, see Have a Nice Day, which basically feels like flipping through a comic book. It's somehow both really flat and static in its animation style, and also just beautiful. Like, there's just, it's this really detailed kind of illustrated landscape of modern day China, kind of through this lens of this very Tarantino-esque, Coen's-esque kind of heist movie about, you know, a stolen bag of money, and these people are trying to scam people on the internet so they can get money for plastic surgery, and there are all these different storylines, and it's something like 70 minutes. It could have gone longer, but it's just like it uses every single one of those minutes, I think, to such hilarious and also very violent effect. I thought it was great.
Number 8, Sorry to Bother You.
Yes.
This one is, it's hard to describe it, I think. IndieWire called it, it's the WTF movie of the year.
Yeah.
Can you tell the premise a little bit?
Sure, yeah. So the main character, Cash Green, played by Lakeith Stanfield, he's kind of trying to work his way up this very mind-numbing a call center job in Oakland. It's kind of set in this sort of slightly surreal version of Oakland. And he has a knack for it. He's able to find his inner white voice so that he can not get hung up on by the people that he's calling at home.
Lakeith Stanfield, you remember from Get Out. A lot of people remember him as the one guy who gets flashed and yells, "Get out."
Yes.
The main character.
He gets to say the title of the movie, which is a great honor. And he's had an amazing year this past past couple of years, actually. And he, you know, finds himself, you know, getting sent up this corporate ladder and going into the higher ranks of this call center, which ends up being sort of a nightmarish, if that's not redundant, Amazon type company. it's about late capitalism. It's about unions. It's about performance art. It's just this crazy mashup.
It's also surreal and like got science fiction in it too. It's
I won't spoil the ending for people who haven't seen it, but I think the visual style of it, this is the director Boots Riley, his first film. He's a musician, an Oakland-based musician, and he had been wanting, he had the screenplay for a while and finally got to make it. And his style is so, it's just fun to see somebody who doesn't necessarily come from a film background get to make a feature film with all their creative faculties. And there's so much visual invention in this. There's a scene where Lakeith Stanfield's character and his girlfriend, played by Tessa Thompson, are they move into a bigger apartment, and they show that by actually transforming the apartment in real time around them, just switching out all the furniture and the backdrop and everything. And it's just so fun and inventive and topical without being preachy, which I think is a hard thing to do. I love this film.
Let's take a listen to a clip.
Let me give you a tip. You want to make some money here? Use your white voice.
My white voice?
I'm not talking about Will Smith's wife. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regalview.
As always, we'll be getting that out to you right away.
You're doing so good with the voice thing.
Holla, 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 holla. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Going upstairs, power caller.
They even have their own elevator.
That would make me want to see it if I heard that clip. We're talking to Vulture film critic Emily Yoshida about her top 10 list of top 10 best movies. If you want to weigh in and tell us about the film that you loved this year, our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. At number 7, Emily, you have Shoplifters, a Japanese drama.
Yeah, it was the Cannes Palme d'Or winner this year. I believe it's still in limited release for New York and LA viewers, at least, and if not more cities. It's by this director, Hirokazu Kore-eda, who is a long time. He's had a zillion films, and a lot of them deal with, they're very kind of subtle family dramas that sort of sneak up on you and gut punch you. And this one, I think, is one of the most effective ones he's ever done. It's kind of about this family living in the margins in Tokyo. Not a typical Japanese story that usually makes it to movies, at least not in the States. So,
number 6 is Eighth Grade. And Eighth Grade is one of those movies that is so sweet and so wonderful and also so cringy for every person who's been an uncomfortable 13-year-old.
And if you haven't, I don't know if I want to know you, honestly.
I know. And something about it, which it's sort of interesting. I felt, gosh, I knew it was hard to grow up being when I was 13, but I can't imagine. Part of this is also about the whole social media culture.
Yeah.
And who you want to be and creating who you want to be when that's not really who you are. So explain a little bit more about Eighth Grade.
Well, I think that the genius of Eighth Grade, and this is another directorial debut, Bo Burnham, who was a kind of YouTube-born comedian. This is he wrote and directed the film. And I think that it does such a good job of portraying this whole world that any adolescent or teen is in right now, as far as, you know, having this separate persona that you're building online, but not being panicky about it, not being alarmist about it, just kind of being honest about the fact that this is just a way that a young girl will try to find herself. And, you know, watching it for me, I mean, I didn't grow up with this stuff, but I could immediately think of all the the equivalents that I was, you know, trying to you know, experimenting with and trying to just figure out who I was via. Elsie Fisher, who's the star in it, is also just such a find. She's hilarious. And it's one of those performances that you're like, is she even acting? And then you see an interview with her or see her anywhere outside and you're like, oh yeah, no, that's not her. She's just amazing at being a 12-year-old girl in this movie. And it's perfect. It's amazing.
Let's take a listen clip when Elsie is trying to befriend two very popular girls who just never look up from their phones.
Hey guys, it's Kayla back with another video. So, the topic of today's video is being yourself. Being yourself can be hard, and it's like, aren't I always being myself? And yeah, for sure. But being yourself is like not changing yourself to impress someone else. A lot of people like call me quiet or shy or whatever, but I'm not quiet.
Most quiet, Kayla Day.
I don't talk a lot at school, but if people talk to me and stuff, they'd find out that I'm like really funny and cool and talkative.
By the way, I like your shirt a lot. It's like so cool.
What?
Oh, that's a heartbreak when she just looks up from her phone and goes, what?
Yeah.
Like, you've been talking to me this whole time? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Hey, we've got some calls, people who want to weigh in on their favorite movies of the year. Hey, Peter from Brooklyn Heights. Hi, Peter.
Hey, how are you?
Doing great. What did you love at the movies this year?
Well, you know, my second favorite movie this year was the documentary Three Identical Strangers. But my absolute favorite movie this year was I got to see Glenn Close in The Wife.
Oh, I liked it.
And she did a Q&A at the Paris, and I got into that, and it was so incredible. And I asked her a question, and she was really engaging, and I just adored the movie.
Peter, thank you so much. Bill is calling us from Harlem. Hi, Bill. What film did you love this year?
Well, two movies. One was Cocote, which is a film from the Dominican Republic. And the second one, the most recent one, was Amazing Grace, the documentary about Aretha Franklin's concert that became the best-selling gospel album of all time.
Bill, thank you so much for weighing in. We're speaking to Vulture film critic Emily Lucia. Lucia, we're going down her best movies of 2018. You know, I hadn't heard of number 5, and then I watched the trailer, and it just, The Rider.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So gripping. Is it a sad movie? It's about a rodeo rider who gets a profound injury.
Yes. It is a sad movie. I won't sugarcoat that. Yeah. It is a real heartbreaker. But there is something about Chloe Zhao, who's the director, and she, you know, she's been, you know, in movie news lately because she kind of went from doing this and now directing one of the next upcoming Marvel movies, which is just really exciting. You know, it's exciting to see what she's going to do with it. But she is a filmmaker who has, she's from China originally, from Beijing, but she came from film school in New York and decided that she was just going to like live in the Badlands in South Dakota and kind of just find inspiration there. So she directed a one feature kind of in a similar way of working with non-actors or first-time actors and sort of being inspired by their story. And The Rider is kind of using that similar method. Brady Jandro, the cowboy in it, was a real rodeo cowboy who had a very traumatic head injury after an accident. And it's just about him kind of trying to find a livelihood after this thing that meant everything to him is kind of taken away from him and he can't ride anymore. And it's just this sort of modern day Western. It draws on all these things that have just been looked great on in movies for decades, you know, riding a horse through a beautiful American landscape, but with a really modern and like unexpected story, I think. So,
and as we finish up, I'm going to pop up to number one, which is Roma.
Yes.
We had the chief curator for film at MoMA, Raj Roy, and he said that this film is really resonating with people in a way that is sort of unusual. How about for you?
I mean, I love Roma and I love Alfonso Cuarón. So I had been looking forward to this one a lot. His last film that he made was Gravity, which is, you know, Sandra Bullock space adventure, which is, you know, fantastic. But it feels like in many ways, it feels like a complete 180 from that. But I think that he's just been figuring out how to work on a bigger and bigger scale to tell, even more intimate stories. And I think that Roma to me is a success because it's able to take this very intimate, sort of not that remarkable story about a young woman who's a domestic worker for a family in Mexico City in the 70s, and just about her, you know, getting pregnant and just like figuring out how to, you know, live alongside this family that she technically works for, with this bigger kind of socio-political backdrop that sort of is in counterpoint with her story. And I just think just in terms of the cinematography and all of that, it's beautiful. But I think that all of the themes kind of come together. It's another heartbreaker too. It's and one of those ones that if you can see it on a big screen, you certainly should.
Yeah, I think you should.
It's,
right?
Yeah, it takes some patience, but it's so rewarding. It's great.
We're gonna let our caller get one more caller in. We're gonna squeeze it in. Tim, who is calling from Harlem. Hi, Tim. You're our last caller on this subject.
Okay. Hi. Am I on?
Yeah, you are.
Okay. The best film I saw this year, and possibly in the last 20 years of my life, is I believe a Swedish film called Border.
I haven't seen Border.
Yeah. And this is it's billed as a modern day fairy tale, and I saw the trailer, and there are two characters who have distinctive facial features, kind of almost Neanderthalish looking noses, and the way that this film unravels over 2 hours and the twists and turns, this is a masterful, brilliant film. It is hands down the film of the year for me.
All right, Tim from Harlem, thanks so much. Hey, Tim gave you something you can go check out.
No, I've been meaning to see Border. I keep missing it. It's I've heard great things though. So, yeah.
All right. So everybody got something out of
yes,
this segment.
Totally.
Emily Yoshida is Vulture's movie critic. Thank you so much for coming to the studio.
Thank you.
Listeners, our phone lines will be open throughout the whole show. Give us a call if you want to get in on our conversations about year-end best of lists. This is the All of It New York Magazine crossover show, and our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. And when we come back, Vulture associate editor Dee Lockett will give us her picks for the 10 best albums of the year. Stay with us. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. This is the New York Magazine All of It crossover show. Let's talk music. Not one genre or artist dominated music this year, although a Dominican Trinidadian Bronx bombshell named Cardi came close. Let's take a look and listen back to the year in music 2018. And to help us do that, we are joined by Dee Lockett. She's an associate editor at Vulture, and she writes about music. Dee, welcome to All of It.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We're getting our callers in on this. They've been calling in, telling us their thoughts. Did you have a song that was your jam this year? What did you have on repeat? Was there anything overplayed or underrated? Give us a call, 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-9692. WNYC. So to the point about this not being the year of hip hop or the year of women of the year, there's so many different kinds of music on your list. You have Kacey Musgraves at number 10, country singer-songwriter. Why does she top your list?
This was a huge year for Kacey Musgraves. This was the year that I think she really caught the attention of the mainstream media. I've seen this top many lists, general lists.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a powerful album. The songwriting is super strong. Some of it was famously written while she was on LSD. There's a song, Mother, that she wrote on LSD. And that's sort of the appeal to Kacey, is she's a very forward-thinking woman who doesn't give much of a about the old rules for country music. She is very much sort of an inheritor of the Willie Nelson sort of state of mind. She is very frank about sexuality. She's frank about drug use. She's frank about speaking up for gay rights. She's a big, big star in the LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's just a beautiful, wonderfully written album.
Yep, she was your number one choice. Let's listen to a little Kacey Musgraves.
'Cause I'm all right with a slow burn. Taking my
Next up on your list is Janelle Monáe. This is one of my favorites. I was sort of thought, oh my gosh, is Janelle Monáe going to go off and be an actress after Moonlight and Hidden Figures? But she's definitely still a musician at heart. The album is called Dirty Computer. It's your number two choice. Is this a bit of a reinvention for her? Where is this in her career?
In a way, it is. Her past albums were all set in the further away future. She's very into the sci-fi narratives, and she's very much of a world builder. But Dirty Computer is more near future. So in a way, it's very Handmaid's Tale-esque. It's a dystopia in a way. So basically, she is still taking on this android persona that she likes to do. And she's fallen in love with a man and a woman. And in this world that she's invented, that's basically considered a defection in her personality and in her computer system. So she's sent to this facility to be debugged, so to speak. And so it speaks to otherness, because mm-hmm. that's just a general theme of the album. And what's interesting is she not only makes albums, everything that she does has a visual counterpart. So this whole album has a short film, also called Dirty Computer. And in it, like, one of her female love interests is played by her new muse, Tessa Thompson.
The ubiquitous Tessa Thompson.
Yes. And it's interesting because a lot of this album sort of got overshadowed by this narrative about her sexuality. She mm-hmm. came out this year as pansexual after many years of speculation. But, you know, that was sort of always in the work. And I think when you listen to the album, she didn't need to say any of that in an interview. It would have been clear in the album itself that this is sort of her coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Out. Yeah.
It's very clear in the lyrics, I think.
Yes. Like, this is her coming out as her true authentic self and who she's always been. But now it's a step closer at her human side.
And the videos as well. I mean, the videos are gorgeous and very clear. Let's listen to a little bit of Janelle Monáe. A lot of the record, people were thinking, gosh, that sounds like Prince, and there's a reason.
Yes. Janelle and Prince were very good friends. Part of the reason why this album took so long is because she began working on it with Prince, but of course, sadly, he passed during that process. And so while he's not actually on the album featured anywhere, obviously, his musical imprint is all over it. Make Me Feel is quintessential Prince, and its video feels very Prince-inspired.
Mitski's number three. And within 3 weeks, I heard this name almost every other day from someone. Explain who Mitski is.
Yeah, Mitski, I think 2 years ago, you would have said she was an underdog in this industry. But with this album, Be the Cowboy, this is her star-making album. It's topping so many lists. The majority of the lists are being topped by Kacey Musgraves and Mitski. It's kind of a toss-up between either of them. Yeah, she has sort of risen, in a sense, as like the new Saint Vincent
of
rock music. She's keeping rock music relevant and interesting. I mean, this is an album that oscillates between grunge. It oscillates between that and then disco. It's all over the place. And her songwriting is just so strong. And what's interesting is there's been a lot of talk lately about whether or not a lot of it is confessional, and it's sort of this like brand of like, are women allowed to speak about anything other than themselves? And she's really opening up this conversation about women and their own narratives and owning that narrative and what the subject matter of songwriting can be.
Let's take a little bit of a listen to Mitski. That was Mitski, and we're speaking with Dee Lockett, associate editor at Vulture, who covers music. We're going through Dee's top 10 list for 2018. Let's take a couple of calls. Bobby from Long Island on line 3. Bobby, what was your song of the year?
Hi. My song of choice for 2018 was Ghost Town by Kanye West. I felt like it just, especially with the mental health struggles he was going through this year, and all the drama of his support for the current president, and just bearing it out in almost this long melody, which went through the highs and lows of what was going through his mind. It almost felt very beautiful to me, and I think a lot of people going through their own mental health struggles can relate to that.
All right, Bobby, thank you so much for calling in. Jonathan is calling from Oakland, California. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. So I actually have like a whole album.
Go for it.
It's the Internet's Hive Mind. It's just a perfect amalgamation of like rap and jazz and R&B and pop and Sid's voice is just so hypnotic. The whole album I've been listening to on repeat ever since it came out. If there's one song I could recommend, though, it's the first one, Come Together. It just really sets off the entire album.
Dee gives you the approval. She gives you the thumbs up on that one. Johnson, thanks a lot. And let's check in with Charles from Brownsville. Hi, Charles. What's your pick?
Hi. My pick is an album that's kind of hits close to home. It's an album that my younger brother did.
Oh.
And through the times of being a jazz musician that played in the subway station and in small jazz clubs, he finally got a Grammy nomination. But the Grammy nomination didn't come until a year after his mother passed away.
Oh,
so,
sorry.
Ironically, the horn that he got was my father's saxophone, which would have been one of the three Coltrane Selmas that John Coltrane would have received, since Sonny Rollins called my father and told him to buy the horn. And Eric got Best Jazz Improvisation for 2015, but for 2016, but my mother had passed away April 2015. So, ironically, though, the album is under a record label that's very slow, so you don't really get to hear much. But if you still want to hear real jazz and hear the Coltrane style of music, that hardcore, unpredictable music, you'll get to hear 18-minute tracks even.
Wow.
But the amazing part is his piano player is more like a bongo or typewriter. And when you film him with a digital camera, you have to film him at 60 frames per second, or you will not see his fingers.
That's awesome. The name of the artist is Eric Wyatt, by the way, Charles from Brownsville. Thank you for calling. We really appreciate it. That was kind of awesome.
That's a nice story.
Yeah. So number four, Teyana Taylor. Number five, Cardi B. Who? No, Cardi B. Number six, Robin with a comeback. Number seven, I'm shuttling ahead because this is on my favorite, the Black Panther soundtrack. Is amazing. Soundtracks kind of, for a while they were really big and then they wandered away. What is significant about this soundtrack?
Well, first and foremost, it was curated by Kendrick Lamar, who is
Pulitzer Prize winner Kendrick Lamar, genius.
What I found interesting about this soundtrack is, of course, he's such a famous rapper, and of course his Rolodex must be deep, so he could have just called up only his famous friends. But in keeping with the theme of the movie, which is, it's set in Africa, obviously, it's set in the fictional country of Wakanda, he pulled in a lot of regional artists. So he hired actually a bunch of South African artists for this album to have them featured all over it. There are people like Babes Wodumo, there's people like Eugen Blackrock. And I think that really, really added to that sort of like African spirit of the album and the movie. It ties it together really seamlessly. And there are a lot of like really gritty songs. There's songs like King's Dead, which is just this like, it's with his label mate J-Rock, and it's just very hard hitting. And it's like, it features in a scene that's just like, it's just so good. And now it's up for Album of the Year at the Grammys. So that speaks to how great it was.
Let's take a listen to a track from it. I like this one. Kendrick and The Weeknd, Pray For Me from Black Panther. Oh, I love that. Makes me do embarrassing dancing in the studio. We're talking to Dee Lockett, associate editor at Vulture, who covers music. We're going through Dee's top 10 list. At number 8, you have the 1975, A Brief Inquiry into Modern Relationships. I was Googling around this morning, and NME just named it Album of the Year.
Yeah.
And they've been, you know, they're one of those like 15-year overnight sensations. Tell people about the 1975 and why they made your list.
So the 1975 are this band that are from Manchester. And they are basically every 15-year-old's favorite band. They really got their start on Tumblr. They are of the Tumblr generation.
Yeah.
But over the years, they've now become sort of like co-signed by the Pitchforks of the world.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They named them their best song of the year was Love It If We Made It. The 1975 are a curious bunch because they, not in a while has a rock band become so divisive. I haven't seen the music blogs really split apart by a rock band.
Yeah.
In 2018, it's so shocking. But I think what makes them so controversial is that their lead singer, Matty Healy, he's let's say he's a bit of a loose cannon.
that's a way to put it, yeah.
His songwriting gets extremely meta. The biggest song on the album, Love It If We Made It, is basically, it's just this whole scrawl of headlines from the year. So it directly quotes Trump, some of his very controversial quotes. Mm-hmm. It quotes things that Trump has tweeted about Kanye West. It quotes headlines about the Syrian refugee crisis. It quotes Lil Peep's death mm-hmm. from a drug overdose. Mm-hmm. And it's just like spitting at you these like headlines from out throughout the year. And, you know, it doesn't really give much of any sort of like resolution to it. There's no there's no solution offered. It's just sort of, these are the troubles of the world and we love it if we made it through it.
All right. We had number 9, Ariana Grande, number 10, Pusha T, which is not safe for public radio. So I think we'll go out on the 1975. You gave it such a good description. Dee Lockett from Vulture Associate Editor. Thank you for walking down your top 10 list for us.
Thanks for having me.
This is the 1975. You're listening to All of It, New York Magazine Mashup. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll be back after the news.